Good morning. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The September issue of Wired magazine proclaims the web is dead. That headline turns out to be a bit of an overstatement, but it points to a major change. Chris Anderson, editor-in-chief of Wired, is referring to the World Wide Web, which is no longer the leading force of the Internet. We've spoken for years as though the Internet and the World Wide Web are pretty much the same thing, that they're synonyms, but you begin by pointing out that they're not.
Yeah, you know, the Internet predates the web. The Internet, it was originally created in the 1970s, and it is the network. It is the wires and the routers that transport digital data. Now, there's lots of applications that use the Internet. The web is one of them, and it's the one we use. But you know, when you think about it, you know, when you make a Skype call, that's using the Internet, but not the web. If you're downloading movies via Netflix, that's using the Internet, but not the web. And over the past decade, the number of applications that use the Internet, but not the web, have grown, specifically driven by the kind of the rise of iPhones and iPads and this mobile computing model, so that the web is now a shrinking minority of the Internet's traffic.
Just to make it totally clear, when we talk about the web, that's one of those pages like on Internet Explorer or Safari or some such thing that begins with a www dot usually, and that's a web connection, but there are all these other ways and other devices and other programs and applications that can get you to some kind of content.
Exactly. You know, the web is by and large the world that you see through your web browser. But if you have an iPhone or an iPad, increasingly you're using apps. And apps are sort of, you know, specialty software that do like one thing well, whether it's maps or a game of some sort. And they don't use the web standards. They don't use a browser. Because of the small screen, you need to have a really focused application that has a user interface that does one thing really well.
Well, let's talk about why that matters to different groups of people. Why does that matter to consumers first?
Well, consumers are driving this by choosing apps. They're choosing to stream Netflix on their Xboxes. They're choosing to buy iPhones and iPads. They're choosing to use dedicated applications, even on their desktop, like Skype, that do the job well because it just makes their life easier. Take Facebook, for example. Facebook is something you experience via your web browser, but Google can't search it.
Okay, you've already hinted at some of the business consequences of this because you mentioned Google. Here's this company that their business model is we're going to be your portal, your window, your door into everything. And suddenly they can't quite be the portal into everything. It affects their business. What are some other businesses and business decisions that could be affected by this switch toward apps?
Well, the biggest one is in the world of professional content, the notion was that advertising was going to support everything, that content would be by and large free, and that it would draw traffic driven by these kind of openness and linking and search engines. You know, we've now clearly seen the limits of that.
You can't make money that way because it's just too many people going too many different directions. You can't get a mass audience to any one page.
Exactly. The advertising model doesn't work anymore. And so now what companies have to switch to a subscription model or any other model where people pay directly for their information and content rather than indirectly through advertising.
Well, let me ask the question that people ask about virtually every new development on the Internet. Is this finally going to be the development that allows evil corporations to capture this gigantic force of community on the Internet and take it over and monetize it?
Oh, yes, that question. Well, you know, extract the word evil and, you know, probably I'd have to agree. Apps and mobile computing is the next big thing. Will there be a next big thing after that? No doubt. But as Tim O'Reilly, the founder of the Web 2.0 conference, said in a debate we just hosted on Wired.com, the web is the adolescent phase of the Internet. And it's dead in the sense that the child is dead when they become an adult. So this is an evolution. There will be more things, but the web phase was not the end of the story. It's not the end of the digital revolution. We are entering the mobile phase now. It has different economics. It has different principles of openness. And no doubt there will be something after that.
Chris Anderson, editor-in-chief of Wired. Always good to talk with you.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The U.S. economy may be on the mend, but it's been a slow recovery so far. We're all still looking for some small signs of hope. Well, here is something from the world of consumer spending. Imports of computers and electronics jumped recently, presumably to meet increased U.S. demand. So we sent Jesse Baker to New York's Upper West Side to find out just what people are buying.
Here's AC/DC with You Shook Me All Night Long.
This shiny new MacBook is set to play an endless loop of rock to help set the shopping mood for at least this guy.
It's a man store. You know, every man loves Best Buy.
That's Anthony Curry. He's here for a gift for his niece and nephew.
Yeah, I'm also looking for a DVD for myself called Marked for Death.
Shopper Jonathan Marin just seems to have a little extra money to burn.
Payday today, it's payday, so I had to walk around and see what I could pick up.
Would you like a bag?
Comfort. That's what shoppers are slowly beginning to feel again, says Andy Hargraves. He's a senior research analyst for Pacific Crest Securities.
If you go back to the beginning of last year, there was so much uncertainty about the economy. People were afraid to spend anything. You know, we didn't know if our houses were going to zero. We didn't know if the world was going to implode. So there just wasn't comfort around any kind of significant consumer purchase.
But these recent purchases are very targeted. People aren't buying so many refrigerators or dining room sets or even flat-screen TVs.
Because really right now, when you peel back the onion, it's largely PC demand that's driving that number rather than just broad electronic sales.
Joe and Sally Cooper already bought an iPad, but still, they're in the market for a laptop.
I'm looking for a small laptop, so it's nice and light and it's easily
to carry.
Carry
so
around.
That we can travel with it.
Right.
Anna Bonarenko was also eyeing up the Toshibas.
I'm actually going back to school, so it was a good time to. My old computer was getting a little rusty.
Back-to-school shopping can account for some of the rise in sales. But according to Andy Hargraves, what we're seeing is a wave of people buying this summer who showed restraint last year.
So it's a bit of pent-up demand that was being released. That may be slowing right now, though, is kind of the interesting thing.
PCs and smartphones are the trendy comfort foods, the brown beans and cornbread or mint chocolate chip ice cream, that consumers are opening their wallets for. For now, anyway. For NPR News, I'm Jessie Baker.
Today's last word in business?
Elizabeth Warren, we got your back.
That would be Elizabeth Warren, the Harvard Law professor. She's said to be one of the top candidates to lead the new Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection. The Bureau was her idea and a key part of the recently passed financial bill.
And apparently some of her fans really wanted to get the job. They're rooting for her with a fervor rarely seen in Senate-confirmable appointments. Hence this music video put together by a liberal group called the Main Street Brigade.
Sheriff Warren's what we need, yo. Let me bleed, yo. She's not about the money and the green, though.
We called Professor Warren's office to see whether she liked being called sheriff. But her spokesman said she had no comment for now. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Many people bought the book and are now watching the movie of the journey of writer Elizabeth Gilbert. She wrote Eat, Pray, Love about her eastward journey to Italy, India, and Bali, seeking to find herself after a difficult divorce. Film commentator Mia Mask says the movie follows a well-traveled path, one that maybe shouldn't be traveled so much.
In Eat, Pray, Love, Bali is Liz Gilbert's enchanted land where she finds emotional healing. The local people are simple, primitive, and mysterious.
You will come back to Bali.
She even befriends a Balinese medicine man she seeks out for wisdom and fortune telling.
You will live a long time, have many friends, many experiences. Also, you will lose all your money. Don't worry, you will get it all back again.
The journey was life-changing for Gilbert, but the film is filled with stereotypes about the East. It's timeless, otherworldly, incomprehensible, and waiting to be discovered by Westerners in search of self. This year, movies about women awakening to their true passions while traveling to the Middle East also include Cairo Time and Sex in the City 2. This trope is not limited to movies about 40-something women travelers. There are epic dramas, explosive thrillers, and lighthearted comedies that don't teach you anything new about Asia or the Middle East. Geopolitical thrillers like Syriana work another part of the stereotype. The Middle East is a land populated by duplicitous people and irrational behavior. In the midst of this chaos, Syriana tries to make Big Oil the villain.
A merger between two U.S. oil companies is taking place in Houston. The new company.
But the film ends up telling you exactly who and where the real problem is.
I'm trying to get undigested information.
Well, to the best of our ability.
India is now our ally. Russia is now our ally. Even China will be an ally. Everybody between Morocco and Pakistan is the problem.
Everybody between Morocco and Pakistan is the problem? Syriana places the irrational Gulf region at the center of global conflict, like the films Babel, The Kingdom, and Traitor. Then there are the epic swashbucklers like Alexander, Kingdom of Heaven, 300, and Prince of Persia. They transport you to arid landscapes for action-packed sword and sandal crusading. But Alexander ultimately confirms the idea that the West is the birthplace of civilization and the East is barbaric land.
Master!
Yeah, well, out with it, out with it.
Why are the Persians so cruel?
Oh, come on. That is not the subject for today, Nearchus, but it is true. The Oriental races are known for their barbarity and their slavish devotion to their senses.
Orientalism is the term academics have given this age-old pattern of depicting Middle and Far Easterners as primitive others.
Oh, I come from a land, from a faraway place.
Nearly 20 years ago, Disney got in trouble for its original Aladdin lyrics.
It's immense and the heat is intense. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home.
Groups like the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee protested these lyrics. Well, nobody's protesting Eat, Pray, Love or saying that you should. After all, it's kinder, gentler, and subtler than Aladdin. But it operates with the same Orientalist repertoire. It may not warrant protest, but its proximity to Orientalist tropes should make you think twice.
Mia Mask is the author of Divas on Screen, Black Women in American Film. She teaches at Vassar College.
Is the sequel to the subprime mortgage crisis a subprime education crisis? The shares of several companies that own for-profit colleges and universities slid yesterday when the Department of Education reported on student loans and who is not repaying them. The non-payment rates for people who attended some for-profits are so high they could jeopardize access to future loans for students at those for-profits. Joining us is Jonathan Kaufman, who's education editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And first, according to the Department of Education, what is a tolerable rate of non-payment of student loans for a college, and where are the for-profits in that, in regard to that rate?
Well, the tolerance is actually pretty high. The Education Department has said that if only 45% of your graduates are repaying their loans, that's okay. But what we found out on Friday is that for-profit colleges overall only have a 36% repayment rate, and some campuses the rate is as low as 9 or 10%.
Some of the for-profits we're talking about include Kaplan University, which is owned by the Washington Post Company, the University of Phoenix, Strayer University. Strayer Education claims that the way they tally up their numbers, they come up with a repayment rate of 55%, and the Department of Education figures it's only 25%. Do you understand disparities that large?
Well, I think everyone is trying to understand that better. I think in the end, the government is going to make the call because it's the government's money, it's taxpayer money. But the investigations we've been able to do up to now suggest that those numbers are correct, but they're clearly in dispute.
You say it's taxpayer money. Who's on the hook for those unpaid loans?
Well, essentially, taxpayers in the U.S. government. This money, it's the student's obligation to pay it back. And that's why the government is so concerned, because what they're seeing is that the amount of money that for-profit colleges have gotten has soared. In 2000, it was about $4 billion total in student aid going to for-profit colleges. Now it's about $26, $27 billion. And they're concerned that if these repayment rates are so low, in the end, the government will be stuck with the bill.
Anyone who's watched any commercial television in the past few years knows that these are institutions that advertise very, very heavily.
They are. And in a sense, I think one way to understand this is that for-profit colleges really are a business. So if you respond to one of those ads on the internet or call the 800 number, you will get people calling you. They're really selling their product. They're not so much in the business as we think of as a college admissions counselor trying to tell you why you should go to a certain school.
The comparison to housing is getting irresistible here. Higher education, like home ownership, is commonly seen as a measure of economic and social progress. People are getting a hard sell the way they might from a mortgage broker. They're getting in over their heads in debt to pay for to pay a premium for education, and then they can't repay it. Do you buy the comparison?
Well, I think that certainly the government is worried about that, and investigations that we've done suggest that that's true, too, because there are two things to remember here. One is, by going to a for-profit college, you're paying a tremendous premium to take a course there, and you're borrowing more money to pay the bill. Now, for-profit colleges will say that's because they're more convenient, they have better technology, but still, their prices are much higher. The second thing is that there's a huge debate about how valuable for-profit college degrees are. Very often, students will sign up for degrees at these for-profit colleges. They graduate, and they discover the degrees aren't worth very much. And that's where the money issue becomes the problem, because not only are students upset about that, but then if they can't get a job, they can't pay back the loans, and the taxpayer is stuck with the bill.
Jonathan Kaufman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Kaufman is education editor of Bloomberg News. He spoke to us from the Bloomberg Bureau in Boston.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. More and more American teenagers are suffering hearing loss. That's according to a new nationwide government survey. As NPR's Patty Naiman reports, it's not clear why, but there is suspicion that wearing earbuds to listen to music may be to blame.
To understand the extent of hearing impairment we're talking about, we're going to play you some tones that will give you an idea of the amount of hearing loss these kids experience. First, this is a high-frequency tone at a normal listening level. Now we're going to lower the volume a little. And teenagers with healthy hearing can hear that drop in volume, but lots of these kids couldn't. Now we're dropping the volume even more. And this is where one in five of the kids tested aged 12 to 19 had difficulty hearing. Researchers say that over the past 15 years, there's been a 30% increase in the number of teenagers suffering hearing loss in this range. Dr. Gary Kerhan of Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston was one of the researchers who analyzed the government data. He says the hearing loss is slight, but studies show even mild hearing loss affects academic performance.
They may be able to hear that somebody's whispering, but may not be able to understand it. And there have been some people who study hearing loss who distinguish between whether they actually can hear and understand the sounds, and whether it's intelligible versus just detectable.
One of those hearing specialists is Dr. Allison Grimes, who sees patients and does research at the audiology clinic at Ronald Reagan UCLA Medical Center. She says we've known for centuries that loud noise damages the ear.
We know that musicians are at higher likelihood of having hearing loss, whether it's rock musicians or classical musicians. We know that when we go to a concert and we walk out of a concert 3 hours later, our ears feel full and stuffy and our ears ring. Those are signs of temporary or possibly permanent damage to hearing from exposure to loud noise.
The study didn't explore why more teens today are suffering hearing loss, but Grimes says there's a pretty likely culprit.
Probably exposure to MP3 players, to personal listening devices, to music would be the suspicion that most of us have.
Grimes says most hearing experts agree if you can hear the music from a teenager's earbuds, it's too loud. And for the teenager, it's likely destroying the tiny hairs in the inner ear that respond to particular pitches and help transmit sound to the brain.
If pieces of that transmission are missing, then the sound that goes up to the brain is not going to be the clear sound that we need to be able to hear to understand speech.
Grimes says research shows the louder the noise and the longer you're hearing it, the greater the risk of hearing loss. And that's why there are standards for noise on the job. And when the noise gets to a certain level, workers are required to wear ear protection and have annual hearing checkups. But for loud music plugged into the ear, the research isn't clear yet. However, Grimes says there are recommendations.
Lower volume is safer, and if a person's going to listen at a higher volume, it's a good idea to turn it off and take out the earphones for, say, 10 or 15 minutes every hour. Give your ears a rest.
For more specific guidance, Grimes suggests going to the American Academy of Audiology website, turntothelift.org. Patty Naiman, NPR News.